I'm Frederick Furbish, and you're listening to F1 Weekly.
There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go. With the qualifying, Steve.
Hello, people. Today we are going to reach out and touch digitally one of our faithful listeners who was a professional race car driver in days gone by. Jeff Klein, welcome to the F1 Weekly Familia. How are you in SoCal today, sir?
Excellent, Nasser. Thanks for calling. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome, and we always look forward to chatting with motor racing fans. That's what we are. Now, first of all, how and when did you find our humble podcast?
Well, actually, I was listening to an English podcast called Side Podcast, and when I was searching around for similar podcasts on iTunes, I found yours and started listening to it and found I enjoyed it very much. So I've been probably a steady listener for probably, I'm going to guess, 18 months or so. You know, I don't know how long you've been doing it, but it seems like I've been listening to it every week for a long time.
Okay, so now, are you like one of those guys and gals out there, racing junkies? I'm one of them, where you spend a lot of time on YouTube watching classic races from decades ago?
You know, I have gone to YouTube and searched races and watched them. I honestly like to watch some of the races that I was in years ago, and in most cases they were long races, so they're spliced into many sections, so it's not the most convenient way to watch a race, but I like to watch a lot of different racing things on YouTube. There's some crazy motorcycle stunts and other things that have gone on, and I'm kind of definitely a race junkie and enjoy any sort of racing stuff for sure.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, you are originally from Southern California, right?
Well, actually, I'm originally from McKeesport, Pennsylvania, you know, outside of Pittsburgh, and I moved out here to go to school in the early 60s, but I've been a native of Southern California since then, yes.
That's good. And as a teenager, this was so impressive when I first heard this from you. As a teenager, you had a close encounter with a man who was driving a Buick station wagon, I believe, and this was shortly after he had driven a shark-nosed Ferrari to victory at Monza and Formula One World Championship. Would you please tell our listeners about this encounter?
Well, it was kind of interesting. I think I was 18 years old, and I had an Austin Healey 106. Actually, it started out as my dad's car, and I took it over from him, and he never got it back. And we used to do a lot of kind of racing up on Sunset Boulevard between Beverly Hills and the 405 freeway. And one evening, I was running through there, and I thought I was going pretty quick, and I caught up with a guy in a Buick station. A Buick special station wagon that had that little V8 that became a Rover engine. And we started racing, and I couldn't believe this guy in this Buick wagon was blowing me off. And we came to a stop a couple miles down the road, and we weren't that far apart, but I had this, what you'd have to consider the superior car. And I look over, and it's Phil Hill. And I was blown away because everyone knew who Phil Hill was. He was, and he'd just become world champion. So interestingly enough, I rushed home as quickly as I could, and being young and impressionable, I sat down and penned him a letter saying, you know, did I have any talent? How can I become a race car driver? You know, the typical thing a teenager would ask. And I sent the letter off, you know, that evening. And about a year later, I get a letter in the mail, and it's from Phil Hill. And I actually have a copy here because I have it framed in my wall here in my office. But it said, Mr. Klein, thank you for your letter and your interest in motor racing. Now, to answer your questions, yes, I was in L.A. on April 8th. yes, I have a Buick station wagon, and I was driving it on Sunset, need I say more, Phil Hill. And it's on the Grand Prix Association, Drivers Association letterhead of that era. And chairman is Sterling Moss, vice chairman, Joachim Bonnier. And then it has members like Cliff Allison, Jack Brabham, Jimmy Clark, Olivia Jean-Debion, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really a cool thing to have. And kind of to bring the letter together, in 2002, I was racing a vintage Formula One car at Monaco, at the Monaco Historics. And I knew Phil Hill was going to be there. And my wife said, well, why don't you take the letter and get him to sign it again? So we went, and she actually chased down Phil Hill's wife and went over, and he signed it again a second time, and was kind of, I don't know, he seemed like he liked the whole idea, and we had a picture taken with him, and it's obviously a letter I treasure a lot, and I, you know, and obviously when he died, I actually treasure it more, so kind of a fun thing, and it kind of drop kicked me to get into race car driving.
Yeah, this is an amazing, amazing story, you know. And if you have a photo, the one that you were talking about just now that you took in Monte Carlo, if you email it to me, we will be so happy and proud to put it on our webpage. That will be much appreciated, if you don't mind.
No, I'd love to. I'm sure I can find it. It's you know, very obviously a very important photo to me.
Yeah, and you know, we always pay royalty checks, which are nothing but zeros.
I've been looking forward to getting one of those checks after hearing about them, you know.
Oh, you just ask for it and you'll have a few. No, no worries, mate. Okay, so this was your great brush with motor racing. And were you already interested in motor? I mean, you must have been, for you to know this was Phil Hill. So what got you interested in motor racing? Was there some interest in the family?
No interest at all in my family. And I was kind of a behavioral problem. My parents sent me away to Valley Forge Military Academy for high school. And coincidentally, my roommate lived near Roger Penske, who was a salesman for Alcoa Aluminum at the time. And I lived too far away from school to go home on the weekend, so I would go back to his place, and we would walk over to Roger Penske's place, and he had all these exotic Porsche RSKs and things in the backyard that he was running in. Well, I guess what was club racing at the time, and we would gawk and talk about how when we got old enough, we would drive racing cars, and I kind of pursued it, you know. I literally, you know, took it seriously, and when I moved to California, it was, you'd have to call it the probably the hotbed of sports car racing at the time, and, you know, and I went to a shop that called Bud Hand Sports Cars in West L.A., and they let me sweep the floor and clean parts and go to the races with them, and you had to be 21 to race. So when I got to be 21, I saved up some money and bought a Lotus Super 7 and started racing after doing go-karts for a few years.
Well, I'll tell you, this business is all about burning desire. Now, Roger Penske, you met him so many years ago. How do you remember him? Any story you have of him when you would see him in those days?
I have to be honest. I remember going over there, and I know we met, but I was so young, I don't really have any remembrance of any interaction with him. The first remembrance I have with him is in 1967. He was driving that Cooper Monaco center engine car, and I saw him at a few races and saw him in Las Vegas, and went up to him and mentioned something about my youth, and it, you know, it didn't seem to register with him. A lot of those guys were so focused that they had people coming up to him at races all the time. So I never really had much of a relationship or any kind of relationship with Roger Penske, but would have loved to, and have sat by the phone patiently waiting for him to call all these years, but it never rang.
Okay. Well, at least I call.
Exactly.
But I'm 2.9 million miles away from being Roger Penske. But, yeah, very interesting story here. Okay, now, last year or maybe a couple of years ago, when you first sent me an email through F1 Info at F1 Weekly, and you were inquiring about these, you know, races we watch, and I saw your name, and I says, I remember this guy from IMSA Racing. And because I had a gentleman you, I'm sure, know fairly well, one of your fellow competitors, Mr. Willie T. Ribbs from San Jose, California. You remember him?
Oh, absolutely. That was his favorite, you know, battering ram a lot of times. You know?
Yeah, I knew him fairly well. You know, we live in the same area, and I went to quite a few races with him. But we'll talk more on that later. Now, looking at your impressive record in SCCA racing, you race some very cool cars, Alfa Romeo, GTA, which I really like very much, BMWs and Porsche. When you were in SCCA club racing, when it was not professional and when you were not career-minded, which of these cars or any other car was the most fun to drive?
Well, I think, you know, the Alfa GTA I really enjoyed because I get a chance in vintage racing to drive them again, and it's like putting on an old shoe. And the BMW 2002s that I drove for a dealership called Hyde Park Motors became, after the fact, 20 years later, very famous, and they're still running in vintage car racing. And when I do drive them, it's like putting on an old shoe also, and I really, really enjoyed doing that. And it was really fun at the time, and I was lucky enough to hook on with the Alfa Romeo factory in late 60s and a guy named Otto Zipper, and then also the 2002s were supported by the Alpina distributor, and I was very lucky to do that because, frankly, I never had any money, so I had to either get a free ride or get somebody take pity on me, so... It took me a long time to grind my way through the different levels because I don't come from a wealthy background, so I never had any money to pay for it myself, so I had to kind of rely on my personality, which sometimes didn't work too well.
Okay. What victories and moments stand out for you from your SCCA club racing days?
Well, it's interesting. When we got the Alfa GTA Junior, literally 20 people got together and put in a little bit of money each, and we bought a factory Alfa GTA, and I got to drive it in Trans Am. But probably the most interesting thing that happened is the first race we took it out to at Willow Springs, I got hit in turn 9 and the thing rolled over. And that was the last race my parents ever attended, by the way. And so I had to go. I was working for Bristol Myers at the time, and I had to go to New York on business. And when I came back, it was all fixed, and we went on to win something like 40 FCCA races in a row with that car, and it was a lot of fun to do, and I got to drive it in the Trans Am, and I looked back at some of the old programs, and there were people like John Morton and Horst Queck and Gaston Andre, and, you know, people may or may not remember these names, but they were all the really famous people at the time. And then in the regular Trans Am at the time, which ran separately, you know, you had Parnelli Jones and Dan Gurney and Sam Posey and, you know, all the traditional Trans Am racing that went on at the time that I didn't realize at the time that it was, you know, it was going to be historically classic time, but it was nice to have been somewhat involved even on the satellite with that stuff.
Now, just to get an idea how times have changed, how much was this Alfa Romeo and what year was it that you bought it from the factory?
It was a 1969 Alfa Romeo GTA Junior, and I believe it was $5,800 delivered. And Alfa Romeo would give us $500 a race to race it in SCCA, which was more than enough money to do it with. So, but I think $5,800 was a lot of money in 1969. But
yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned your folks. This was the last race when you rolled over. Now, was that the reason they would not come again?
That's exactly the reason that they wouldn't come again. I think my mother was traumatized and on. You know, they didn't really talk too much about racing, and I did it for a number, obviously 30 or 40 more years. And then it was kind of touching that when my dad passed away, I got a book, and he had every press clipping that ever existed on me, and it was kind of nice to know that he was following it, but he never ever mentioned it again, you know?
Oh, I can understand that.
Okay,
yeah. Now, the Alfa Romeo factory deal, how long was this, and how did you find working with, this was your first brush, I would imagine, working with the factory team?
Well, it was. I mean, it was very much an amateur level at the time. I mean, even though it was FCCA, and it was 1969, 70, and 71. And what they did is basically pay Otto Zipper, who was a famous car owner at the time, an Alfa Romeo dealer, to maintain the cars and take them to the races and so forth. And it was very much professional because we had a truck that the cars actually went up on, like a car hauler as opposed to a flat trailer. So it was very impressive, you know, at the races, that sort of thing. And it was fun working with the Italians. Like, you know, every year they give you a really nice piece of, artwork or something that I still have that's really nice.
Now, talking of Alfa Romeo, I know you've been to Europe. Have you ever been to their museum in Arese outside Milano?
No, I never have. But the car that I drove in Europe a few times, that Alfa 12C37, which is a 1937 Grand Prix car, I understand because I've seen pictures that they have a chassis of that hanging from the roof in the middle of the the atrium in the entrance of the building. I don't know if it's true or not, or if it's still there, but it's supposed to be an impressive place. I'd like to go someday.
Okay, now we come to IMSA racing, and that's where I heard of your name first time. How long were you in IMSA competition?
Well, my first race was actually 1975 at a six-hour race at Riverside, but I didn't run again full-time until 1979 with Racing Beat and the Mazda factory team. And I stayed with in IMSA from steadily from 1979 to 1992. So I had a pretty nice long run.
And IMSA in the 70s and 80s attracted a lot of attention from the Federales. Please explain to our listeners what IMSA stood for in those days and any stories you can share with us, like racers paying for expensive parts from cash in a shoebox.
Well, it was kind of interesting. They called it the International Marijuana Smuggling Association. And so there were a lot of South Florida people who reputedly were involved with drugs and spent some time in the Huascal for that offense. And, I had one run in where it was 1984, we were running Sebring, the 12-hour race, which we ended up winning in GTU in a Mazda. And one of the guys that was driving with us brought the sponsor along, and when they went to pay for the tires, they had a Halliburton case, and the guy opened it up, and it was full of money and some sort of 45 pistol or Glock or whatever they had in that era. And the guy at Goodyear, you couldn't believe how big his eyes got as he opened up this case. And it was kind of like Pulp Fiction, you know, every time they opened that case and it glowed. And he peeled out the money to pay for the tire bill. It was kind of weird. But apparently things like that went along all the time, you know, in the era.
Talking of Halliburton, was Dick Cheney working as a pit crew member?
Oh, yeah. No, he was too busy founding the Axis of Evil at the time.
You know? Oh, I'm sure. And what better place to start than a racetrack?
Okay. Exactly.
Yeah, and, I, as a fan of, I'm a serious fan of motor racing history, when all this drug money came into IMSA, one of the gentlemen, if I may use that word for him, he got life without parole, Randy Lanier. And I've tried to find out why he was given such a severe punishment. Do you have any info on this that you can share with us, please?
Well, obviously I don't know for sure. I was fortunate enough in that whole era I spent in IMSA, probably 90% of it was racing for factory teams that had legitimate budgets. But I did have some interaction with Randy Lanier, and would see him standing at a payphone with a roll of quarters, doing whatever business he was doing. But I don't know if it's true, but I mean, I heard that he was the largest marijuana smuggler ever, and that apparently he kept his mouth shut and was willing to go to jail rather than, turn in his compatriots. So I don't know if that's true or not, but I don't think we'll ever see him again to ask him.
I understand. Okay, now the GTP cars of the late 80s and early 90s were beautiful machines. Your thoughts on driving those machines?
Absolutely. I mean, I started in 85 in GTP Light, the Camel Light series, in an Alba Mazda that was sponsored by the Mazda factory and Malibu Grand Prix. And an Alba was a kind of an interesting car for the time, and it was a lot of fun to drive. And it was, as I say, run by Malibu Grand Prix and sponsored by the Mazda factory. And then I got to drive an Argo GTP. I drove a Royale GTP, a Taiga. Then I drove for the Spice Pontiac factory team in 87, where I think I had 13 poles and 12 fastest laps and won 6 races, and we did really well. And that was basically a 4-cylinder engine Spice. And then I drove a 962. I drove the Nissan GTP. I drove the Jaguar GTP. And I think totally I probably did about 130 GTP races. So I was very fortunate at the time to be able to drive those cars in competition, and they're amazing cars. And every year for the last 9 years, I've gone down to Sebring in March and driven GTP cars in a 3-hour race that they have back there, and it's a lot of fun to drive them again. They're amazing cars.
And I remember distinctly the Malibu Grand Prix car Mazda when Tommy Candle was driving for them, and he was with them for a while too.
He was. In fact, Clayton Cunningham ran the team, and Ira Young was the owner of Malibu Grand Prix. And actually, I got Tommy the ride in a sense because it was offered to me, and I didn't want to drive RX-7s anymore. I wanted to drive GTP cars. That was 86, and so I passed on the ride, and Tommy got it and did a wonderful job, and he became famous, and he's obviously a great driver and deserved everything that came from it. But had I probably not wanted to drive GTP cars, he may not have gotten that opportunity. But he's a great guy, and he deserved it.
He's also from Southern California. Are you guys friends?
Definitely we're friends. You know, I don't see him very often anymore. You know, Southern California is a big place. We have some mutual friends, so we kind of keep track of each other that way. And my wife and I were invited to his wedding, which several years ago, probably 10 or 15 years ago. And so, you know, we had a nice relationship. I wouldn't call him my best friend, but he is a very good friend and a really nice guy. And I think anybody who had an opportunity to spend much time with him would realize that he's a real quality guy.
I've met him a few times when he was racing, and I have to agree with you, nice guy. One of your Southern California, probably you also know him, he's one of my all-time favorite hustlers. And I had a very high opinion of him, and I still do as a race car driver, road racer, and that's Mr. Robbie Gordon.
Oh, he's a pretty amazing guy. I had an interesting story with him. I was driving with Darren Brasfield and Paul Genelosi at Daytona in 1992 in one of the carbon fiber Oldsmobile, you know, GTO cars. And Robbie and I all night for about 2 hours were nose to tail. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, he had a little brain fade and went straight through the chicane at 190 miles an hour that's on the back straight at Daytona. And I asked him later, and he just said he just lost orientation. You know, thank God there wasn't a wall there. But that was Robbie. You know, he's like incredibly fast and, you know, incredibly wild. And it was kind of fun to be going back and forth with him for a couple hours in those cars in the middle of the night. And, you know, a lot of things like that happen.
Yeah, when he was in Trans Am, I mean, I followed his career since he was in Mickey Thompson, you know, thing. But when he came to IMSA GTO Trans Am, the guy was amazing.
Yeah, he's got incredible car control, and I think you see it in NASCAR also. I don't think, unfortunately, he has the best equipment in NASCAR, which is obviously vitally important, but I think he's a real amazing talent.
Yeah. Have you seen how well he does when he goes to a Dakar rally? Incredible.
Oh, I love the Dakar rally and those things. I mean, it's fantastic. It looks like a lot of fun.
Now, in 1989-90, you were a test driver for factory Nissan GTO 300ZX. Beautiful car. I remember that car. I believe it was red, white, and blue. And,
correct, yeah.
And I remember one particular race, and I remember Steve Mullen was driving this car. He made an incredible move in a corner, and this was at the very first race at Heartland Park, Topeka, Kansas. Were you also at that race?
I was at that race driving the Applebee Spice, the GTP car.
I remember that car very well.
And, you know, I don't remember Steve. Obviously, I was in the car, and I think we were all running together in that race. But those were amazing cars with the same engine that the Nissan GTP car had with no downforce. And it was a very, very, very difficult car to drive, very hard to drive. And Steve is an amazing driver.
Now, it's very hard to get a factory drive for any team, any manufacturer. Nissan had a pretty big operation. How did this deal come about?
Well, Clayton Cunningham, who ran the Malibu Grand Prix team, by that time was running the Nissan GTO team. And so they had a situation where they needed some test work done. So John Morton and Steve Millen, who were driving the cars at the time, were occupied somewhere else. So they asked me to do some testing, and then I actually had an opportunity to run a race with them at Watkins Glen and then at Lime Rock, Connecticut. I'm proud to say that I still have the driving suit from that era, and it also still fits amazingly.
Now, there was a gentleman by the engineer, Don Devendorf. I believe he was running the Nissan program. Where is he these days?
Well, Don was running the GTP program, he and I actually drove together in a Ferrari Daytona in 1978 at Daytona 24 Hour, and then we were arch rivals when I was driving for the Racing Beat RX-17 back then. And I think he's like a brilliant engineer, and he does a lot of projects for different companies that if he told you about them, he'd have to kill you, that sort of thing. And it's my understanding that he is back doing some very sophisticated electronic research for some defense, contractors, and lives in the San Diego area. But I haven't seen him for probably 4 or 5 years, but we have some mutual friends again that kind of keep in contact, but I haven't seen him personally.
Now, you have been very successful in the Sebring 12 Hours and Daytona 24 Hours. Will you please tell our listeners some of your achievements there?
Well, I mean, I was really lucky. Someone said once that I could fall on a toilet and come up with a diamond, and that's kind of what's happened to me sometimes.
I hope you never tried that.
Yeah, well, I never literally tried it, but I can understand the analogy. In 1981, a guy, Bill Cole, and Rob McFarlane and myself ran a RSR Porsche GTU car at Daytona in the 24 hour, and that's when all the 935s were running and things like that. And we were lucky enough to win GTU, but amazingly, we were third overall in the race and only spent 14 minutes in the pits. And, it was quite an accomplishment that I don't think was broken until Kevin Buckler's team won overall at Daytona a couple years ago. So that was one win at Daytona. And then the second win I had at Daytona was in 1987 with the Spice Pontiac team, where we won the GTP Light category. And that was kind of an incredible race. But talk about falling to a toilet. We were leading the race by about 45 minutes in our class. And about 10 o'clock in the morning, the car just grinds to a stop. So I get out of the car, and I'm still hooked up to the radio, and I'm looking around, and I open the engine compartment in the back, and I'm looking around, and I start yanking on wires, and miraculously, I pulled the wire from the coil out, and it had broken inside the insulation. We would never have found it. It was just dumb luck. So I was able to twist the two wires together and drive back to the pits, and they fixed it permanently, and we went on to finish the race. I think we were ninth or tenth overall and first in Camel Light, so that was really lucky. And then I won Sebring in class three times, once in 1984 in a Mazda RX-7, and which was kind of interesting, seeing though I drove the last 5 hours and 45 minutes because no one wanted to drive at night, and was totally dehydrated and was dragged off to the hospital for some electrolytes after throwing up on the trophy presenter girl, who would never talk to me again the rest of the year, but I don't blame her. And in 1986, we won in a Camel Light car Royale with a guy named Jim Rothbart. He owned a satellite company called STS. And then I won, won in 82 with Roger Mandeville and Amos Johnson in an RX-7. So I was pretty lucky there, and I won four times at Elkhart Lake 500, three times at Mid-Ohio, twice at Riverside, and I think I won 19 IMSA races, GT races overall, which I think put me in the top five all-time winners, I believe, but I might be wrong there, but somewhere up in the top 10 anyway.
Yeah, still very impressive. Now, talking about driving at night, as a racing driver, when you're driving at night, is the focus and attention that you're paying more than in daytime, or is just another race at just another time for the driver?
Well, I think it takes a little bit more focus, but, you know, after doing so many of these races, we had a little of experience, and I think the whole key is setting up the lights, and obviously you want lights that go ahead brightly, but you would angle one light on each side to pick up the apex. If you couldn't pick up the apex, you were totally lost, and so we would do that, and then at Sebring, which was like black, it was like driving on the moon, it was so dark, we would go out and we would spray the apexes with iridescent paint, and only we knew about it, so when the lights picked it up, we knew at least where we were going, because Sebring, early on, you'd have a runway that was about 200 yards wide, and you could be on the right side and get to a turn, and it would be a third gear turn, or you could be on the left side, and it would be a fifth gear flat out 140 mile an hour turn. So, you know, you had to keep your eye on the ball game, and it took a lot of concentration, that's for sure.
Now, in the time you raced an IMSA competition, there were a lot of good drivers and a lot of competition, factory effort, this and that. Who were some of the drivers you were racing against that you thought were good drivers? Or in other words, if you had a team in those days, who would be your drivers?
Well, I mean, John Morton, who's one of my best friends, I've always thought that he's fantastic and totally underrated. But I was also in races with Danny Angais, who was pretty wild and crazy and fast. Hans Stuck, I was in races with him. I was in races with Peter Gregg, who was very precise. I drove a race in 1975, I think I said, in a Ferrari Daytona at Riverside, a six-hour race that Ronnie Peterson was in, driving the factory BMW. Brian Redman's fantastic. I co-drove with Davy Jones and Derek Daly at Le Mans, and both of them were excellent, and Davy was a really, really fast driver and really good. I thought Price Cobb was probably extremely underrated and really good, and you know, Jeff Brabham obviously was fantastic. There was one guy, Joe Vardy, that I've driven with that I think probably is one of the fastest race drivers anywhere, and he's gotten very, you know, little recognition for it. Martin Brundle drove for the Jaguar team when I was in GTP, and I always thought he was probably one of the better drivers, and I could see why he was so successful in Formula One.
Okay, among the names you have mentioned just now, Davy Jones, you know, in 1982, I had taken a trip to England to go to tracks and go to Monza for the Grand Prix. And in those days, Davy Jones was racing in Europe in Formula 3, if I'm not mistaken. I know he had a bad accident at Indy. What is he doing these days? Do you know?
Well, a couple years ago, I know he tried to race again, and never was able to pull it off. And I know he has some repercussions of his bad accident. And I know he was married to, the guy from Houston. Yeah, John Meekham's daughter, who was a very sweet girl, but I believe they got divorced. But I have no idea what he's doing now, but, you know, he's a great guy and really fast. I mean, really fast. I remember at Le Mans, you know, I think before the race, I got 11 laps total in the car because they kept putting tires on the car and sending Davy out to get the pole. And, you know, that was in the days before the chicane, and I think we're averaging 137 miles an hour or something like that for the lap. And, I mean, he was just blindingly fast.
Okay, now, Jeff, 1989 Le Mans 24 Hours. You were driving a Selkirk Jaguar at Mulsanne for Tom Walkinshaw Racing. Is that the coolest thing you have ever done with your racing suit on?
No question about it. Going 252 down the Mulsanne was an incredible thrill.
Now, how did you get this ride with the Tom Watkins Show?
Well, Tony Dow, who was the American team manager, kind of took me under his wing. And I'd had several good races with when I was driving for Spice with the Jaguar team, and did very well against them. And Tony asked me if I'd like to do Le Mans, and I looked at him like he was crazy. Of course I would. So he took me over there with an American team that was myself and Derek Daly and Davey Jones. It was an amazing thrill. Car broke in the race, but the whole ambiance, the whole situation. Well, you know, you went there this year. It was amazing.
Yeah. And now there's an interesting story that you were driving 150 miles per hour plus, and then somebody passed you on the Mulsanne, and you. And what did you do when you came back in the pits?
Well, the first time I got in the car, you know, and they had all that telemetry, so you had to suck it up and go through the Mulsanne kink flat out. So I'm going down the Mulsanne straight about 246, more or less, 246 miles an hour, not kilometers. And I got passed by one of the Sauber Mercedes. John-Louis Schlesser was driving it. So after the session was over, there was a guy, John Gorsline, who sells insurance to race drivers. And I went and found John, and I bought disability insurance. I figured if I died, I'd be in good shape. But if I was maimed, I'd be in horrible shape. So I bought disability insurance. And the really funny thing was is that Ari Leyendijk was in front of me doing exactly the same thing with Gorsline. So we both had the same thought process.
Oh, geez. And did you say 240 miles per hour, not kilometers?
Yeah, 246 miles an hour. Yeah, 246. Yeah, that's fast. That's the first few times I felt like I was really going fast.
Wow. Now, when you're traveling that fast, is it just a car going fast, or do you really feel, hey, this is going a little too much?
I think it's more a thought process. It didn't feel particularly fast because you came on to the Mulsanne straight and you got into sixth gear, and it literally creeped up. You know, the tack would just creep up slowly, and they had only 2,000 pounds of downforce on the car at 240 plus miles per hour, so it actually was fairly difficult to drive. It also had a locked rear end, so that if a half shaft broke, you could get it back to the pits and repair it. But the one thing I remember is after you go through the Mulsanne kink and you're going through the next right-hand slow corner, you come up a little hill and you had to rest your foot on the brake to get some brake temperature, or otherwise you try and stop for the right-hander, which was about 60 miles an hour, and you'd never make it. So you had to remember to ride the brake slightly with your left foot in order to warm up the brakes so you could use them after being on a 4 mile straightaway.
Now, when it's when the driver like yourself, you have to go and take some rest, can you really get some sleep with all that thing going on, or how do you program yourself for night driving?
Well, I think you have to rest. I think, you know, you have to kind of discipline yourself so that you can sleep, you know, in the couple hours that you have to rest. Otherwise, you're going to pay for it later. So I think it's a discipline thing. And the nice thing about Le Mans was that each driver had their own little caravan, you know, that you could sleep in. At Daytona, it's a little more crude. If you didn't have a motorhome or you didn't have a team that was rich enough to have a motorhome, you slept in the back of a pickup truck or just about anywhere that you could. But Le Mans was pretty first class. It was pretty amazing.
Now, your teammates have been some very interesting characters. Dieter Quester is a name I have known since the 70s. How did you hook up with him? And please tell our listeners, especially the young ones, who Dieter Quester is.
Well, Dieter Quester is an Austrian driver that drove for the BMW factory in the 60s, 70s, 80s. And for all I know, he's probably still driving. I saw him at Daytona recently in a Porsche 997, you know, GT car. He's a pretty amazing guy, and he's kept himself in great shape, and he's a wonderful driver, and he was like one of the amazing guys in the 70s in these BMW 3.0 CSL Batmobiles and things like that. And he and I drove Daytona and Sebring together in 1989. And I was basically the factory driver for Spice. And he brought along a sponsor, and we drove he and I and Kostas Loos, who was a Greek race driver of good repute, I guess you could say. And you know, we ended up driving together for two races. Unfortunately, Dieter swallowed a plastic piece of a glass at Sebring and couldn't make the race, so Kostas and I ended up driving the whole thing ourselves. But Dieter was a really nice guy, and we're in email contact occasionally, and he's still doing really well.
And his dad used to work for BMW, you mentioned to me in our previous conversation.
I believe, and I believe that his father-in-law, his wife's father, obviously his father-in-law, was the competition director at BMW in the 60s and 70s. So he had a nice leg in, but in all fairness to him, he was a phenomenal race car driver and deserved every ride he ever got. I think he probably ended up with his wife after he was already driving with BMW.
Now, the second name you mentioned, Kostas Loos, even though it's all Greek to me, I do remember this guy racing here in the U.S. in IMSA competition. But I understand racing was smooth sailing for him, but reaching his dad was quite an adventure. Please tell us his background and why it was hard for him to talk to Papito.
Well, his father apparently was like one of the largest ship-owning Greeks, you know, in the world. And I was shocked to hear once that he had mentioned just very casually that he was trying to get an appointment to see his dad. And apparently he had to call and make an appointment. He just couldn't drop in and say, "Hey, Dad, what's going on?" So that was kind of a shocking thing for me. I'd never really heard that before, you know. It's kind of strange, don't you think?
Yeah, but you know what? If the dad's sponsorship check is not bouncing, why bother him?
That's true, and dad came through in the pinch. I know they ended up, he and a guy named Jean-Louis Richey that owned the Nino Richey perfumes, who I raced against and raced with also, they went on to resurrect Allard and run Allard in GTP racing. So they had the bucks and ended on racing. Everyone loved them, you know. They were nice people, too.
Oh, that's good. Okay, now here is another one of your co-drivers, Joe Varde from Florida. And I understand you have a story to tell about doing the Mossport six-hour race with him.
Well, that's actually a funny race. Joe, if he listens to this, he'll squirm a little bit. But we went up to Mossport, and my wife and I went, and we went through practice and so forth. And I'm going out to run because I'm kind of a physical fitness nut, and I'm going out to run, and he and my wife are in the hot tub, and I thought nothing good could come of this. And we come back later and have dinner, and then we at the hotel we were staying at, he and my wife were out there dancing, and Joe was about 5'2", so the two of them were out there, and they were like two chihuahuas on diet pills. And I'm thinking, you know, this is going to be interesting. So the next day we have a six-hour race to run, and Joe's not feeling that well, and he starts the race and is supposed to go an hour and 45 minutes. And after about a half hour, he comes in and says he's not feeling well. So I get in the car and I drive for an hour and 45 minutes. And I come in and I think that Joe's going to be there, and Joe's not there, but his helmet is. And I have to put his helmet on and go out and drive as if I'm in Joe. I'm Joe. So I go through this whole process for 5 hours and a half. And we finish the race and I'm on the last lap, and I look as I'm going by the pits, and there's my wife and Joe hanging over the pit wall waving at me. And I drove 5 hours and a half of 6 hours, and he slept in the truck. And since I wore his helmet every other run, he got full points for it. So I've never let him live it down. And he and my wife are still great buddies. You know, they have a lot of fun together.
Okay, well, you mentioned if he's listening. If he's not listening, if he hasn't found F1 Weekly by now, please let him know to listen to this story.
I will.
Is he? Yeah, I remember meeting him in 19 when I first came to the United States. Actually, the very first race I went to in the U.S. was the Trans Am race at Sears Point. And I remember going up to him, and he was he driving a Dodge? What was he driving?
Yeah, I think he had a deal with the Dodge factory, and I think he was driving, I forget the model, but, you know, it's that little Dodge thing that they ran in the, the NS series then, yeah.
Yeah, and there was a gentleman by that name, by the name of Cal Shockett. He was originally from Iraq, you know, and I met him also. Do you remember those guys? Do you remember him?
Absolutely. I drove a few races in that series, and, Cal was really good. And he was a phenomenal racer. I think he was from Alabama or something like that.
Yeah, he was, and then he moved, I think, to Sonoma, which is where Sears Point is. Okay, I'm looking at this list of cars that you have raced. Now, check this out. Ferrari Daytona, in my opinion, is one of the most beautiful cars ever designed. And then you have, let's take a look here. I will mention names that you may not have mentioned here. The 1972 Ferrari F1312. How did you get into this car?
Well, Symbolic Motors, which is a Ferrari dealer out here, they, for quite a while, for probably a 10-year span, they would hire me to sort out these vintage Formula One cars they would buy, and people would buy them. And they had a very special client in Japan that bought a lot of vintage Formula One cars, and he wanted them shipped to them with the patina on them, as if they'd just been out to the track. So I luckily would get paid to go out to Willow Springs and flog these things all day to get a nice patina on them. And one of the cars that I drove was Gilles Villeneuve's car, you know, the one with that funny front wing.
Yeah, 79.
Yeah, 79. I drove that, and then I drove several cars for him up. And I think the last one I drove for him was a mid-90s, I think a 94 Ferrari F1 car, and I drove an 83 Ferrari turbo car. An Alpha Turbo Formula One car. I was lucky enough to drive a lot of kind of good cars when they were obsolete.
Yeah. The Alpha Turbo Formula One car, what is the difference when you drive a similar era Formula One car, which is non-turbo and a turbo? I mean, when you get that, when the turbo kicks in, is it really very powerful?
It's unbelievable, actually. It's, you know, a 1,500cc V8 that's making 1,250 horsepower, and it's an 1,100 car. It was amazing, and Andrea de Cesaris has been the original driver of this car, and I'm only 5'8", and I had to take every bit of padding out of the car to fit in the thing. I mean, he must be 5'1". I mean, it's unbelievable. I could hardly fit in the thing, but it was an amazing car to drive, and the weird thing is that I got to drive the car in a race at Willow Springs that had, like, Porsche Speedsters in it and Porsche 911s. And, you know, I'm, like, blowing by these people doing laps that are 45 seconds a lap faster. But it was an odd thing, and that sometimes happens in vintage car racing.
Interesting. Okay. Now, I have to request a big favor for you. If you are ever driving any of these old Formula One machines at Willow Springs, now, I don't know if you do it on a weekdays or on a weekend, but if you know in advance that you'll be driving one of these F1 cars, if it's on a weekday, let me know and I'll call in sick, because I would love to see a Formula One car in action. And talking of driving De Cesaris Alfa Romeo Formula One car, how many dents did the car had?
I had a lot of twitches. I came out of it and I was twitching. I don't know. It must be contagious.
Yeah, he, you know, in 1982 when I was at Brands Hatch, McLaren team was there testing, and there was Niki Lauda was testing there, and Keke Rosberg was there. And so I was talking to this young kid who was like an apprentice with McLaren team, and I asked him who was driving for you last year, and he says second driver was De Cesaris. And I said, how was he? And he just gave me a look, and he says, you know, awful. He said he kept crashing all the time. So that's Andrea De Cesaris for you. But moving to Formula One these days, your thoughts on the Singapore crashgate and the verdict that came down. What's your thought? Is it too lenient, as the world is saying? Or?
Well, I think they could hardly keep Renault from... I think if they penalized him too much, they would drop out. I don't think they can afford to have another team drop out, so... You know, at the end of the day, it's all political, but I think they were right to kick Flavio out. I mean, I think he's a bore, if that's the right word. I mean, it's he just is shocking in what he's gotten away with, you know, over the years. And, you know, I don't think PK Jr. was any bolt of lightning, but I also don't think he was treated, you know, very well on the team. But I think he's probably killed his chances of ever driving, at least in Formula One, by having accepted that. I mean, there's just some things that you draw the line at and don't do, and there are too many variables with crashing your car purposely on a street course. It just doesn't make sense, you know? And I can't believe that they were so desperate to win that they would pull something like that. I'm very disappointed in it, you know?
Yeah. When the allegations first came out, purely as a racing fan, did you even believe that this is possible?
Well, you know, I couldn't believe it was possible, but then again, where there's smoke, there's fire, and it just made all the sense in the world. But I'm just absolutely shocked that, one, he would admit it, and then, two, the whole thing unraveled like that. I would think that if you're going to do something like that, and I'm sure it's not the first time that somebody pulled something similar to this off, that you would make sure that you kept it pretty tightly. You know, I mean, why would they? I mean, when they let him go, they must have assumed that he was angry enough that he would have turned on him, which is exactly what happened.
Yeah, that amazes me more than the prearranged crash. I mean, that you are blowing out a guy who knows such a secret about you, and if they had blown him at the start of the season, I would understand. But with only a few races to go, you know, but it's just very, very bad all around.
I was surprised, just to add one more thing, that, I mean, that McLaren got fined $100 million, you know, dollars for, you know, snatching the plans, apparently, you know, for Stepney Gate. And then, you know, these guys get off with a two-year suspended, you know, life or whatever the ban was suspended. So it doesn't seem to hold true. Either McLaren was grossly over-fined or, you know, the crash was grossly under penalized, so doesn't make sense to me. But there's more going on than I know, that's for sure.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of things going on there. Now, who would you like to see win the world championship this year?
I'd like to see Button do it, just because he's so close and it's so frustrating. If he couldn't do it, I'd like the two-legged Rubino to do it. And but I'm a real Lewis Hamilton fan. But I, you know, obviously he doesn't have a prayer this year, but I think either one of the Brawn drivers, just because they came from nowhere to do it, has made at least the first half of the year has really been exciting, and hopefully the last couple races will improve on what we've seen the last few races. But you know, the first probably three or four races are the first ones that I've watched from the entirety at regular speed, you know, on my TiVo. I mean, they were worth watching for sure.
Now, you've been following Formula One races for quite a few years. Let me ask you a question. If not in any order, if I was to ask you, in your opinion, who were the best drivers, the top five or the greatest drivers since you've been following, not in any order, what names will come to mind and why?
Well, I have to kind of leave out the 50s and 60s, because I you know, they weren't on TV and I never really got to, you know, watch them.
Sure.
But I see in the era that I've been able to watch it and really interact with it, as much as I'm not a fan of Michael Schumacher, I think he was excellent. I wasn't a real fan of Ayrton Senna, but I think he was excellent. I love Nigel Mansell, because I just loved his aggression and, you know, the fact that he just strangled whatever car he was driving and just made it work. I like Martin Brundle for kind of personal reasons, just because I raced against him and I thought he was so good. And I think Lewis Hamilton is probably as good as you can get. I mean, he's just an amazing talent. So, you know, Alonso, I think Alonso's good, but again, I'm not a big fan of Alonso, but I like the underdogs. I actually even like Eddie Irvine. I wouldn't put him up there with all the great drivers, but he brought a lot of spunk to the whole thing and a lot of personality. I liked it that he was willing to fight with Ayrton Senna at the first race, not only on the track, but he was ready to get the punch out with him.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned you were not a fan of Senna and Schumacher. Explain that, please, and also explain the absence of a name that I thought you might say, Alain Prost.
Oh, you know, I forgot Alain Prost, but I thought he was a good, but I like people like Mansell because they have such passion.
Hustlers.
And people like Schumacher and Senna and even Alain Prost were so robotic about the whole thing. And, I respect them as drivers, but I kind of go for people that have a little bit of personality if I'm going to root for them, you know. And I separate the excellent drivers, which I consider them all excellent, from the ones that have personality that I actually can get behind in a race and hope that they do well.
Now, talking of personality, how about Kimi Raikkonen? The personality never changes, whether he's winning, losing, driving a good car, crashing, somebody crashing into him. It's always the same mood.
I love him on the, you know, in the interview after. My wife gets a kick out of it, too. She's a psychologist. And she just shakes her head, and he's great. So car was good, and I did very well, and I pushed hard, and he's amazing. What do you always call it, the Finlandia vodka? He must be pickled somehow, you know, but he's amazing. He's a real talent, too, but I think that you miss. I think he's got a lot of passion that apparently doesn't come through.
Okay, Jeff, it's been great talking to you. And before you go, a couple of requests. How about a message to fellow listeners, please?
Well, to all the people out there, I enjoy F1 Weekly, and I know all of you do. And I really, just a word out to all the guys at F1 Weekly that I really appreciate the podcast. I listen to it in my Mini Cooper S all the time, and I really enjoy it. And just remember, even at my advanced age of 65, I'm still enjoying racing and like racing, and just keep the passion.
Well, passion is what it's all about. Okay, so Jeff, it's great talking to you. I wish you all the best. And if you are ever in Northern California, please let us know. We should get together for some taquitos or Mongolian beef or some California-type thrill, okay?
Excellent.
This is Desiree for F1Weekly.com, thanking you, the subscribers and members of our listening audience, for listening to our podcast, reporting and commenting on Formula One, the highest echelon of motorsport, a blend of technology, tradition, glamour, and guts, all wrapped up in a high-speed package. That's F1Weekly.com for all your Formula One needs.